Senate Committee on Agricultural and Natural Resources, February 2nd, 1989, 3 o'clock p.m., Hearing Room C.
For further hearing on that and the companion bill, as well as a work session on 39, we're going to try to get to those today, assuming we can keep a quorum for work session purposes. The log export may well carry over, given the elements and the fact that everyone wants to get out of here as soon as possible because of the weather. So we're going to try to deal with the elements and deal with a busy agenda and try to accommodate you the best we can. And I hope folks will understand if anyone has got a real pressing time problem other than the ones I've already acknowledged, please try to let us know and we'll hang in there as best we can. I'd like to start off with a groundwater issue. Then we were expecting the chair of EQC, Mr. Hutchison. He is called and is stuck in Portland battling illness and the elements. And Mr. Hansen, I believe you are ready to lead off that discussion at this time. Is that correct? And I hope we're getting our sound system. We're working on that, but I don't want to delay our start, and we'll go ahead and proceed while we work on that as well. I know we've got a lot to cover, and we'll try to move just as quickly as circumstances permit, I know. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Fred Hansen, Director of the Department of Environmental Quality. With me is Greg Pettit, who oversees our groundwater efforts. You'd already mentioned that Chairman Hutchison, Chair of the EQC, was sorry not to be here. He was intending to. His illness prohibited that from happening, but did want me to indicate that he would have liked to have been here and will be looking toward speaking with each of you later. What we hope to be able to do is for me to be able to cover a testimony. I may abbreviate parts of it in the interest of time, and then Greg would cover really a slideshow that really highlights the problem areas, and then you will hear from some of the other agencies, because of course this is a multi-agency effort as well as a multi-interest effort. In Oregon and across the nation, groundwater contamination is becoming a major concern. Groundwater has been perceived as a renewable resource that is clean, readily available, and plentiful. By far, most of Oregon's groundwater is unpolluted. However, as recent groundwater pollution incidents indicate, such as what we saw in Milwaukee from TCE, groundwater is vulnerable. Careless practices can ruin groundwater for its many uses and ultimately threaten public health. Over 50% of Oregon's population depend on groundwater for all or part of their daily water needs. 94% of the Earth's fresh water is groundwater. Future groundwater uses is expected to increase significantly to meet demands for domestic, agricultural, industrial, and municipal activities. In 1987, the Oregon Commission on Futures Research stated in its legislative recommendations that groundwater protection should be the first priority among the state's resources issues. As groundwater meets a basic, very basic need, its protection is critical for general public health and the state's economic and environmental health and well-being. Across the nation, many states have either recently adopted or are developing groundwater protection legislation. Wisconsin, for example, has adopted a program that establishes groundwater standards incorporating preventative action levels and enforcement levels. When the preventative action levels are exceeded, actions are taken to reduce the contamination. When the enforcement level is exceeded, mandatory actions are required to achieve compliance. Iowa has adopted a program that takes a different approach. The Iowa program emphasizes research on best management practices that will be protective of groundwater and implementation through non-regulatory mechanisms of public education, demonstration projects, and incentive programs. Many other states, such as New York, Connecticut, and Florida, have adopted programs that classify groundwater according to use and have separate groundwater quality standards for each classification. Over the past 3 years, the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality and other state agencies have become aware of the need to develop programs to effectively protect, conserve, and manage the state's groundwater resources. The common consensus is that the state needs to evolve from reacting to groundwater contamination after the fact to being proactive and addressing potential sources of groundwater contamination before they in fact produce contamination. Greg's going to go through a series of the problems, so I'm going to skip over that portion of my testimony. I would like to note that attached to my testimony is a map taken from the Oregon Environmental Atlas. That was that large brochure publication that we provided to you. That really highlights where groundwater contamination was found at the time of the publication of that map. Contamination from point sources, such as landfills or industrial sites, generally affect areas limited in size, from an acre or less to a few square miles. And again, not to minimize how big a few square miles are, but at least defined limited area. Such contamination may be at relatively high concentrations. But because of the limited area and high concentrations, it may be feasible, although usually extremely expensive, to clean the contaminated groundwater. Contamination resulting from non-point source activities, such as on-site sewage disposal or agricultural chemicals, usually occurs over large areas covering from several hundred acres to several hundred square miles. Because of the large areas and the low concentrations of contaminants, cleanup efforts become less effective and, in many cases, impossible. The length of time contamination may remain in groundwater varies greatly. This period is determined by characteristics of both the individual contaminant and the aquifer contaminated. Groundwater moves very slowly, often only a few feet per year. Once contaminated, groundwater may remain so for hundreds or even thousands of years. It is because of this problem that it is essential that an effective groundwater quality protection program be preventative and not reactive. In groundwater protection, an ounce of prevention is worth much more than the pound of cure. There are many federal, state, and local agencies and programs that have a direct or indirect effect on the use and protection of the state's groundwater resources. The table that's attached here lists those programs and the agencies that are involved. Often, as a result of differing program missions, there are inconsistencies or conflict between programs. Senate Bill 423, the Groundwater Protection Act of 1989, requires coordination among these programs and the state agencies that implement them. Even though Oregon's groundwater problems do not appear to be as serious as those elsewhere in the country, the development now of a comprehensive groundwater program will go a long way toward ensuring that serious groundwater problems do not occur in this state. The legislation before you focuses on addressing deficiencies in Oregon's existing groundwater protection programs, mainly interagency coordination, assessment activities, and non-point sources. The proposed legislation is the result of a long and thorough evaluation of Oregon's groundwater management needs. The product is not the result of one agency's initiatives. Rather, it comes from an extensive consensus-building process that involved the strategy development, a copy of the document has been provided to the committee, an interagency committee, work with the Joint Interim Committee on Environment and Hazardous Materials, a legislative retreat at Subtle Lake in September, and two citizen work groups. All the participants agreed that Oregon needs a comprehensive, proactive groundwater management and protection program. Through a consensus-building process, workshops prepared recommendations on the various topics addressed in the issue papers. Following the groundwater retreat, two work groups were formed to take the recommendations that came out of the retreat and help develop a legislative proposal. One group dealt primarily with the issue of non-point sources, and the other dealt primarily with funding issues. Attached to my testimony in Attachment B, as you can see, the list of individuals that were on these committees. They represented a broad range of viewpoints. The work group members did a commendable job of unselfishly working in a spirit of compromise to develop an Oregon approach for groundwater management. The approach emphasizes win-win solutions. The emphasis is on the development of non-regulatory programs to address groundwater concerns before they become critical problems. It was felt that the traditional regulatory approach was the least effective way to protect groundwater. What was needed was basic research and public education coupled with implementation incentives. Funding for implementation of the Groundwater Protection Act is contained in a separate piece of legislation, House Bill 2176, the bill on which I testified before, not you, but before the House committee yesterday afternoon. The governor has proposed using $3.7 million from the Hazardous Substance and Groundwater Protection Fund for the groundwater program. These monies would be used to support activities in five agencies, as well as provide grants to Oregon State University and other qualified applicants for projects related to groundwater protection, such as research, public education, demonstration projects, and incentive programs. We can state with confidence that money invested in developing a preventative approach to groundwater management today will yield enormous dividends in terms of resource availability for future generations. The legislation includes the following goal statement and nine elements. Groundwater protection goal, and I'm going to read this slowly because I think it is the key to what we are attending. Quote, the Legislative Assembly declares that it is the goal of the people of the state of Oregon to prevent contamination of Oregon's groundwater resource while striving to conserve and restore this resource and to maintain the high quality and quantity of Oregon's groundwater resources for present and future use. Other elements. Hydrogeologic characterizations would identify location, extent, and vulnerability of groundwater resources within the state. Groundwater monitoring would identify background water quality, identify trends in groundwater quality, provide early warning detection of deteriorating groundwater quality, identify critically affected areas, evaluate the effectiveness of groundwater management programs, and help ensure protection of the public from exposure to toxic substances in groundwater. Next, it would provide a state groundwater database, which would be maintained to provide current information to all of the agencies involved. Next, it would emphasize research to be conducted to develop economically viable management practices which can be substituted for current practices that are shown to have adverse groundwater quality effects. Statewide public education and demonstration programs would be funded so that the public will know the hows, whats, and whys for protecting groundwater quality. Action plans would be developed through local groundwater committees to implement non-regulatory programs to maintain and restore groundwater quality in areas where groundwater quality is being adversely affected, but contamination has not yet reached critical levels. Aquifer management plans would be developed for critical areas where groundwater quality has deteriorated to those levels that threaten public health or beneficial uses. And this would involve the state at that level. State agency groundwater management activities would be coordinated. And lastly, technical assistance would be provided to local governments. A more detailed summary of the legislation is attached as Attachment C to the testimony. Groundwater contamination problems are far more expensive to correct than they are to prevent. Unfortunately, most of the state's past and present efforts have been directed toward finding solutions for existing problems rather than providing prevention of potential problems. The passage of the Groundwater Protection Act of 1989 will move the state into a more effective long-term role of protecting, conserving, and managing the state's groundwater resources for the benefit of future Oregonians. Thank you for the opportunity to appear before you. We can answer any questions now or turn to Greg Pettit's slideshow, which really emphasizes the problem areas.
Let's see the slideshow, and then we can take some questions.
Thank
Excuse
you.
Excuse me, Representative Cease, I know that you wanted to speak with us. Is your schedule such that you'd like to speak with us now?
I'd be happy to look aside.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity to present the slide. So I believe I'll present it from over there. That way I can operate the slide, if that's all right.
Fine. We'll have to make sure that we can pick you up on the tape, and I'm sure you'll speak loudly enough so we can hear you as well.
All right, I'm sure I will.
Yeah.
Everything's under control. So mechanized system.
Well, groundwater as a resource is very underestimated in terms of its value, because most people, being out of sight, most people aren't aware of groundwater unless they see it in a spring or a well or something like that, but it's just hidden, and you know, people don't generally think about its value or how important it is. But if you look at the total world water supply, most of the water in the world is in the oceans or in the ice caps, but if you look at the difference between groundwater and all the water, the rivers and lakes and streams and freshwater lakes and whatnot, the Great Lakes, you can say that a much greater percentage of it is in the form of groundwater. In fact, 95% of the world's available fresh water is in groundwater. That's probably a good figure for Oregon as well. This map here, I don't think you can read the figures, it's not quite in focus, but it indicates the amounts of groundwater in terms of millions of gallons per day that's withdrawn. That's the upper figure. The lower figure is the surface water figure that's used in each state. And if you could read it in Oregon, you'd see that about 1.2 billion gallons per day, or million gallons per day of groundwater were withdrawn in 1975. Groundwater provides many beneficial uses. Probably the most important of which is it provides a drinking water supply for both public water supply systems and those rural residents that don't have public water supply systems available are usually almost totally dependent upon groundwater as a drinking water source. In addition, groundwater supplies tremendous quantities of water for irrigation. And in terms of quantity, the largest quantities of groundwater are withdrawn for the purpose of irrigation. Many parts of Oregon rely upon groundwater irrigation to provide for a agriculture that would otherwise not exist. The resource is abundant. No matter where you are in Oregon, if you drill a well deep enough, you're probably going to find groundwater. And it's available. You don't have to build a dam to store it. Nature's already provided that in terms of the reservoirs that are the aquifer systems. In most situations, it's high quality. It provides for many beneficial uses, including industrial and drinking water supply, many others, and it provides the base flow of our streams. The flow that flows in our streams in the summertime is met by groundwater. And in fact, changes in groundwater quality are going to be reflected in changes in surface water quality. When we get into looking at addressing problems like in the Tualatin Basin, what we consider background or natural levels is really more a reflection of the groundwater quality. And that changes with man's activities as well. We don't really know a lot about groundwater in the state of Oregon until very recently. Because you can't see groundwater, there's a lot of myths and superstitions and whatnot about groundwater, some of which are that it occurs in rivers or lakes and streams. That's usually not the situation. There's a lot of mythology associated with water, groundwater, because people don't understand it. But in fact, groundwater is simply saturated geologic formations that lie beneath the surface of the earth. Groundwater comes from precipitation falling on the land surface, percolating down through the soil until it accumulates in these aquifer reservoirs. And from there, it moves off into a discharge point, usually a river. Groundwater typically occupies the pores or spaces and the fractures in the rock or the spaces between particles in the soil, not in large caverns or underground rivers. It's more like a bucket of wet sand. This diagram here is a little bit technical, but I think it provides a lot of information, and if I could, I'd like to just point out a couple of things. We have a pointer there. Because I think to understand groundwater problems, you need to understand a little bit about the groundwater flow system. And the thing that I wanted to indicate on this was that this here is a river, and this is an upland position. Groundwater moves in these long circular paths down deep in recharge areas, pushing it down deep into the surface, and then it moves up into the recharge areas. This has very important factor to consider when you're talking about groundwater management programs. Because if you have to realize if contaminating activities are occurring up here, it's going to be a long time before that groundwater works its way through the system and comes out here. And in fact,
this year's wells may be contaminated here, but next year's wells may be contaminated there, and it could work its way deeper and deeper. The other thing that you can see by looking at this slide is that the length of time groundwater takes to move through the system depends at where it's at here in the cycle. Groundwater moving from here down through here and up to here might be in that cycle for tens of thousands of years, whereas groundwater in a short loop like this may pass through that system in a matter of months even. This slide here shows dye has been injected into a simulated groundwater situation. And you can see how the dye from the lower right-hand quarter is moving up into that little channel in the center there. That's like an ant box type of experiment. So you can see that how groundwater moves up towards these discharge points. This shows how groundwater is going to affect the flow when you put a well in and start pumping. Or a well is going to affect the flow of groundwater. This shows how you would get recharge. This is a dye has been injected into this trench, and that could be an on-site sewage system. It could be an irrigation canal, but it shows how the contaminants are moved down by the higher forces, the hydraulic head that's created by that recharge point. Well, we've only recently realized that groundwater is vulnerable to contamination. We used to think that it was naturally protected by the soil's ability to filter out the contaminants and by a number of natural processes. But monitoring has indicated that this just isn't true, and we're finding increasing examples of contamination. No one activity is the culprit here. All types of activities have result and can result in groundwater contamination. This list here is fairly comprehensive, and all of these kinds of activities have been shown to cause groundwater contamination. The types of contaminants we typically find in groundwater are nitrates, organics, heavy metals, other metals, then heavy metals, and increases in salts. Hazardous waste disposal was one of the first activities that focused a lot of attention on groundwater problems. As a result, the CERCLA program and the RCRA program were created at the federal level. These increased the monitoring activities around the country. As more monitoring was done, more contamination was discovered, and this has just snowballed into basically the discovery of more and more problems. Contamination from landfills and these things can seep out into our rivers and contaminate them as well. On-site sewage disposal is an activity in Oregon that we've had a program that addresses for quite some time and can affect the groundwater when either the soils aren't proper for that type of system or there's just too many systems in a small area and they overwhelm the capacity of the system. Groundwater contamination from on-site septic systems has been discovered in East Multnomah County and North Albany and Clatsop Plains in North Oregon coast. In the La Pine area, several other locations around the state. The types of contaminant levels we're seeing there in terms of nitrates are in the range of 5 to 10 milligrams per liter usually. The nitrate standard for drinking water is 10 milligrams per liter. Recently, we began an assessment of agricultural contaminants in groundwater in the state of Oregon. We have found, and other states have found, that certain agricultural activities can leach contaminants down into the groundwater. We participated in an interagency survey from 1985 through 1987. All these agencies were involved. It was very much a cooperative project. We tested 380 wells for nitrates and 216 for pesticides. We sampled in the areas which are the most vulnerable to contamination based both upon characteristics of the aquifer and the agricultural practices in the area. You can see that the shaded regions indicate sensitive aquifers in the state of Oregon, aquifers that have rapidly draining overlying soils and are shallow, and that makes them more sensitive to contamination from surface activities. The circled areas are the areas that we concentrated our sampling in, the Willamette Valley, Boardman, Ontario, Klamath Falls, and Curry County.
If I can focus it just a little bit better.
This slide indicates the percentage of wells that exceeded the drinking water standard in each one of the sampling areas. You can see that I can't read it and I don't have the numbers memorized, but I believe it was about 36% of the wells in the Ontario area exceeded the standard. and 42%, I believe it was, in the Boardman area exceeded the nitrate standard. Very serious problems in these areas with nitrates in groundwater. Nitrate concentrations were found in wells that have caused death in other states. Nitrate contamination can cause methacloma anemia, the blue baby syndrome, and there are other concerns about high levels of nitrates in drinking water. We did find high nitrates in at least some wells in all the areas that we sampled. In terms of pesticides found, 67% of the wells that we sampled in the Ontario contained the pesticide Dacthal. And in Curry County, 80% of the wells we tested contained a pesticide, either 1,2-dichloropropane or Alducarb or both. In the Willamette Valley, 25% of the wells we sampled contained pesticides. The worst contamination was in the Ontario area. We tested 107 wells. 37 wells were greater than 10 milligrams per liter nitrate nitrogen. We tested 81 wells for pesticides. 54 of those wells contained Dacthal or DCPA. One well contained Tolone, another pesticide. The problem with groundwater contamination is that it's very hard to monitor. We can't just go out and collect a sample with a bucket like we do out of a stream. We have to drill a well or take it out of a well, and once we do that, we only know what's in that particular location. You don't know what's next door or a little bit deeper or a little bit shallower. It's very hard to clean up because you don't have access to it, and the problems, once it becomes contaminated, that contamination can remain in the groundwater for very long periods of time. There are a number of existing statutes that give us authorities to deal with groundwater problems. Solid waste, sewage disposal statutes, our general water pollution control statutes, and our hazardous waste statutes. The DEQ's activities have been guided by a general groundwater protection policy, which was adopted by the Environmental Quality Commission in 1981. And it has a general policy section, a source control policy section, and a problem abatement policy section. This has proven to be fairly effective in addressing contamination resulting from point source activities, and we have used this to guide our activities in a number of different programs. In the there's two divisions in the DEQ that provide most of the activities in terms of groundwater protection. That is the Water Quality Division and the Hazardous and Solid Waste Division, which has just recently been divided into the Environmental Cleanup Division as well. In the Water Quality Division, we implement our groundwater protection requirements through WPCF permits, through our on-site sewage disposal program, and we conduct statewide assessments of groundwater quality and do planning work for groundwater protection in that section. In Hazardous and Solid Waste Division, there is extensive groundwater protection and monitoring and cleanup requirements in the Resource Conservation Recovery Act program, also in the Federal Superfund program. Our solid waste program has very extensive groundwater protection, monitoring, and cleanup requirements. We have groundwater monitoring and cleanup requirements in our spill response program, and two new programs that were created in the last legislative session also are primarily targeted towards either protecting or remediating groundwater problems, the underground storage tank program and the state remedial action program. Nationally, of the money that's being spent from the Federal Superfund program, about 90% of that money is spent on groundwater-related assessments and remediation. Of these general kinds of sources of contamination, there is existing regulatory programs that are administered by the DEQ for on-site, urban runoff, industrial sources, underground storage tanks, and hazardous waste disposal. However, one of the goals of the legislation was to address inadequacies in our overall programs to protect the quality of groundwater. And currently, there is no comprehensive program in the state that provides solutions to groundwater problems that are resulting from the use of agricultural chemicals. This was one of the areas that we wanted to address in the legislation. As the director has already spoken to, there was a very long and thorough process in developing the legislation. We reviewed the existing programs that address groundwater and prepared what we call a working document, but it's about a phone book size assessment of all the regulations in the state, laws and statutes that have anything to do with groundwater protection. From that assessment, we developed a strategy which identified the gaps in existing programs for groundwater protection and contain some recommendations. At the governor's request, an interagency task force was prepared last summer, met six times, prepared a series of issue papers. Following that, the Interim Committee on Joint Committee on Environment and Hazardous Materials had a retreat at Subtle Lake, Oregon, where groundwater issues were discussed in some detail. And finally, the drafting of the legislation was done by citizens, work groups, and agency personnel together. The issue papers addressed a number of areas that we felt needed clarification through legislation to improve our overall efforts to protect groundwater quality and quantity. One is we needed a more clearly defined groundwater protection goal. We needed to ensure that we had consistent implementation of our groundwater quality protection goals amongst the various agencies. We did identify some problems where there seemed to be different agencies going different directions. If I might, just an example in that area is there is a regulation that prohibits the use of storm drains for stormwater disposal, and yet other agencies were commonly installing these kind of storm drains along highways and this kind of thing. So we needed to make sure that we had consistent implementation of these programs throughout the different agencies. We needed expanded hydrogeologic assessment work because we needed to know what our resources were, where they were located, how productive they might be, what the potential of these resources were, and what their vulnerability to contamination was.
Shift gears here slightly to hear briefly from gentleman Mr. Bill Brown, who is available part of our agenda to discuss generally and respond to questions regarding solid waste. And he is here through the auspices of Mr. Gallagher, who requested the opportunity to allow him to speak with us this afternoon. He was scheduled for 5 p.m., but because of a flight earlier, he's asked for the opportunity at this time. Is Mr. Brown with us today? He may have had to leave to get back to Portland. If that's the case, then we will proceed with our testimony, and our next individual signed up is from the Health Division, I believe. We do have some written comments from Mr. Brown here. They're being distributed. Mr. Boydston?
Yes.
Welcome.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Jim Boydston, manager of Drinking Water Program in the State Health Division. I think you're all aware the Health Division is responsible for administering the federal and state regulations on public water systems. We think there is a definite need for this kind of preventive interagency program concerned with groundwater. There's an increasing public awareness of the impact of particularly organic chemicals in groundwater, and we think that that public awareness is going to increase. Milwaukee is a good example, as you heard earlier, and I'm sure you're aware of what can happen when we begin to do some sampling, some monitoring for organics in groundwater. I think there are a couple of lessons that we learned from the Milwaukee incident. That is that when we look for organic contaminants in groundwater, we're going to find it. And secondly, that there's going to be public concern, and that concern is not so much with whether the water is at or above standards that are set, but a concern that any organic in the water that may be considered as a carcinogen is going to really be of concern. City, in the case of Milwaukee, upon their monitoring, when they did find some organics, did conduct public meetings. They went public with the information immediately, and Health Division and DEQ participated in those public meetings. In the case of Milwaukee, they did have an obvious immediate solution to the problem, and that was by switching to Portland water. Many of our communities are not going to be that fortunate to have an immediate alternative available. I think that example of Milwaukee is a reminder that Oregon is no different than the rest of the country in the need for monitoring and protection of our groundwater resources. There are new federal and state rules mandated by Congress that are going to greatly increase the amount of monitoring and the treatment requirements that must be met by public water systems. These systems are going to be monitoring now for 83 contaminants instead of the 25 contaminants that have been monitored for in the past. Most of these new standards are going to cover organic chemicals such as industrial solvents and pesticides. And these contaminants have long-term effects. They're not the immediate acute effects of some of the things such as microbiological contaminants that we've monitored for in the past. This is one of the reasons I think that the public is concerned about what the impact is going to be if traces are found in their water. We're just now developing a technology to measure these contaminants down to very low levels, and another reason why we are now setting standards that are just down to a few parts per billion. We're currently doing the first round of testing in cities over 10,000 population. They will collect quarterly samples over a year, and then the next year, cities between 3,300 and 10,000 population will begin monitoring. In the third year, cities below 3,300, or public water system below 3,300 population, will be doing monitoring. I'm convinced that we will be finding new problem areas as this testing is done, as I mentioned earlier. The bill, I think, is good in that it does require interagency cooperation and development of action plans to find and provide some cure for the problems that we do locate. The Health Division's role will be to provide public health support and advice to state agencies, county health departments, and to the public. I think one of the important things to remember is that there's very little baseline information available on what contaminants are present in groundwater. We've done very little monitoring in the past. Greg Pettit mentioned some of the interagency studies that were done in Ontario and some other areas in the state, but that's just a beginning. Our new drinking water regulations will require that 850 public water systems will begin to monitor for some of these organics that have not been tested for in the past at all. And this alone, I think, will trigger much more public concern about health risk associated with these contaminants. This is the reason that the Health Division does support Senate Bill 423, because I think that is going to be a real effort to help keep groundwater supplies safe. One other comment I'd like to make, that is that we have looked at the bill in detail, and we are suggesting one friendly amendment. There's a provision in Section 13 that all private wells, which are not regulated at all, will be required to test for nitrates and for bacterial contaminants at the time that an individual wants to sell his house. We would like to see that broadened slightly to permit the Health Division to set rules requiring some additional testing if any of the agencies identify an area of groundwater concern. And we have suggested to DEQ as the lead agency that we consider that amendment to the bill. Thank you.
Okay, any questions for our witness? Mr. Boydston, do you have any idea how many transactions we're talking about in terms of these private transfers that would require well testing?
I think that's going to be a large number, Mr. Chairman. We currently receive requests from lenders asking if houses or properties are on an approved water system. And we can provide that information for public water systems, but with current regulations, there's no testing done. And that will be a significant number that will go into a database and help provide information on where we do have problems. But testing for nitrates and bacteria are not expensive, probably in the neighborhood of $20 for a sample. If they are required to do testing for organic contaminants, that can be $200 and up for a sample.
And you may want that authority in certain critical areas?
If only in those areas that have been defined as groundwater areas of concern, where if, for example, we find an area where perhaps some public water system wells have arsenic, as an example, then we think it would be important to know the private wells in the area that would also be showing arsenic.
Further questions? If not, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bradbury.
I realized I had a question for Bill Young. Would it be appropriate for him, or we have a whole long list that we need to move through here?
We'd be more than glad to hear from Mr. Young at this time in response to your question.
Bill, I was just looking at this, the measure summary, and it talks about changing statutory references on critical groundwater areas to emergency groundwater areas. And I wanted to just understand, there's been a great deal of, as you're well aware, a great deal of sort of dispute and controversy over the critical groundwater area and declaration of critical groundwater area. By renaming it, what are we doing to the process, if anything, to the process of declaring and implementing practices in a critical groundwater area?
I think, Mr. Chairman, Senator Bradbury, that the change of the name does nothing. It simply broadens it to reflect the added concern about water quality as well as water quantity, which has been the major focus, as you know, of the so-called critical groundwater area that we've had. The change that is made that may make it a more workable system is also included in this bill, and that is to make it clear in the statute that the business of deciding what kind of an aerial extent we have where we have a problem is not a contested case at all, but it's a matter of making rules. We, by rules, say there's the area we're concerned about. Then if we were to move into the area and propose to do something to abridge somebody's ability to use water, the bill also makes it abundantly clear that that is a contested matter, and that has to be done with all of the protections that are provided under the APA for contested activities.
Okay. I'm glad we talked about that, because that's something we've tried to do in the past. It's been, I gather, you know, sometimes controversial or whatever, but we have tried to do that so that you're not into a contested case just in terms of your declaration of a critical groundwater area, which is very difficult geologically to prove.
It's been a very difficult problem, and of course the problem stems originally from the fact, I think, that the genesis of the critical groundwater statutes predated the APA, which went to some length to describe what the differences were between rulemaking and contested matters. And in our statute, it simply says you hold a hearing. And
right.
We've been to court a number of times trying to understand what the nature of that hearing is. We hope to clarify that here.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Okay, any follow-up questions on that? If not, thank you, Mr. Young. Okay, we've got some representatives here from the City of Portland. Welcome, and please be sure to identify yourselves for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Joe Glicker. I'm the Director of Water Quality and Environmental Policy for the City of Portland Water Bureau, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak before you today. I'd like to just briefly give you some background about the perspective that we come to in looking at the bill, and then with me today is Bruce Niss, who's the manager of our Water Resources Protection Programs, and he has some specific comments, suggestions that we have on the bill. We supply water from a surface water supply and also from a groundwater source. Our groundwater source has 22 wells supplying over 100 MGD, 100 million gallons a day. It's a backup system to our normal surface source. It's the largest municipal groundwater system in the state and actually is one of the largest in the country. We have an extensive monitoring program for groundwater contaminants, looking for over 100 contaminants in our wells, including pesticides and organic compounds and radionuclides and a whole mess of other things. We have a staff of hydrologists, geologists, water quality experts that we are and participate in national committees and organizations on drinking water regulations and groundwater protection legislation. And our well field began to be developed in the early 1970s when groundwater contamination was not an issue. And the reason for that was that our technical level of understanding is much less than it is today. So we are now faced with the issue of groundwater contamination, and we're faced with it from two basic sources or comes at us from a couple of directions. One is, as Representative Cease alluded to earlier, there's been a site near our well field, an industrial site that has found some groundwater contaminants in it, and DEQ is in the process of getting cleanup at that site. the area of our well field is also the area of what's called the Columbia South Shore, which the city of Portland has designated as the prime area for new economic development and economic industrial development in the city. And with that brings the range of potential groundwater contaminants. We're also faced with being left holding the bag as the water purveyor if groundwater prevention doesn't work. As the water purveyor, we must meet all federal and state regulations, and many of those new regulations are those of groundwater contaminants. We also must meet our customers' expectations for the lack of organic contaminants in our water, even if there aren't regulations for it, which in many cases for groundwater contaminants is currently the case. And we have to pay for all this, pay for any treatment, pay for the additional monitoring, and we have to do this in times when public resources are short and when the demands for those resources, even within the water area, is great as we try to do more and try to reduce risk. As a result, in dealing with all that, we have developed a groundwater protection plan for our well field area. It's a wellhead protection program. It's a program that was developed after several years of study with public input, review processes, including input from economic development interests, environmental interests, other state, federal, local agencies, landowners in the area, a whole range of people. It incorporates state-of-the-art knowledge and information that we've gleaned from contaminant problems elsewhere in the nation. There's some basic elements in that groundwater contamination plan, and I think in the handout there's kind of some summaries sheets that describe it. We've established some land use prohibitions. We have specific design requirements for those land uses that are not restricted, monitoring programs, inspection and enforcement activities to help supplement the state's statutory responsibilities and resources, hazardous materials, response coordination, and planning for future activities. The outcome is a plan that we have in place now that we believe is supportive of economic development, and in fact we believe is now promoting economic development in an area, and at the same time is protecting our environment. And what we've learned from this experience is that when a water supplier is present in this situation, we're in a position to provide some unique expertise and coordination efforts in making groundwater protection happen. We also know that groundwater does not necessarily follow political boundaries, and that therefore our program is only a wellhead protection program. We need the help of the state in the form of legislation such as this is proposed so that we can establish a groundwater protection program that is based on the aquifer, based on where the groundwater goes as opposed to where our political boundary goes. We've also found that when done right, groundwater protection can support and promote economic development while protecting the natural resources on which the long-term economic viability of our community depends. And with that, I'd like the Mr. Nist to talk about some of the specific suggestions we have on the bill.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name again is Bruce Nist. I'm the manager of the Resources Protection Program for the Water Bureau, which includes both the Bull Run Watershed Program and the Groundwater Protection Program. The City of Portland Bureau of Water Works supports Senate Bill 423, specifically, the Bureau believes that allowing a local government to obtain the state's assistance in development of a groundwater protection program before contaminants are found in the groundwater is a milestone in protection of this vital resource. Because it is the local government's water purveyor that must obtain the financial and technical resources to treat contaminated groundwater before distribution, and because the water purveyor is in daily contact with its ratepayers regarding the cost and effectiveness of its services, water purveyors must play a significant role in the decision-making processes regarding management of groundwater on both a statewide and a local basis. Therefore, the majority of the comments that the Water Bureau has on Senate Bill 423 are intended to demonstrate ways in which the water purveyors utilizing a groundwater supply can play a larger role in the implementation of SB 423. The comments that we'll present are done on a section-by-section basis as follows. In Section 7, concerning membership of the Groundwater Protection Advisory Committee, we're suggesting that the legislature should consider opening up membership on the committee to communities that utilize any groundwater at all, rather than communities that are limited to using their entire supply as groundwater, as the bill appears to currently do. In Section 9, the water purveyor utilizing groundwater should also be added to the membership of the Environmental Quality Commission's Technical Advisory Committee. Next to the regulators, as I've already stated, the purveyors usually are the ones who are most familiar with the health effects of various contaminants and the feasibility and the cost of treating water that have various types and amounts of these contaminants. In Section 17, concerning the secondary check on the contaminants that are in the that could be found in groundwater, the laboratory used to determine the extent to which the groundwater is contaminated should be what we refer to as a certified laboratory, certified by either the state of Oregon or the federal government, for analyses of the specific contaminants in question. Analysis for organic contaminants such as pesticides and industrial solvents like TCE that has been previously referred to are extremely method sensitive, and these tests must be done in laboratories that have excellent quality assurance and quality control. Section 19, subsection 1, the local advisory committee in an area of groundwater concern should again be required to include a water purveyor utilizing groundwater. Again, it's the water purveyor that has the best knowledge of treatment costs and feasibility and that has an intimate knowledge of the concerns of the water consumers themselves. In Section 20, concerning what it is that we call an area when we find the possibility of these numerical standards being violated, we believe that the water purveyors, the water purchasing public, and the state of Oregon as a whole would be better served by changing the name of the emergency groundwater area to something like a groundwater enforcement area. Obviously, we agree with the need to rally governmental agencies and the public to the prevention and reduction of groundwater contamination, but we are also concerned about the image that will be created by the use of the term emergency before a true health emergency is actually created. What we hope to avoid is some kind of a knee-jerk reaction that would affect the business operations of the water purveyor and possibly economic development prospects of an entire region. It would also reduce the stigma of blame that would certainly be attached to any segment of society that contributed to the contamination and the resulting, quote, emergency, unquote. Lastly, in Section 26, we believe some clarification is needed in line 15 on page 7, where the bill uses the words reduce or prevent. There's an obvious difference. While we understand that the intent is to reduce the overall volume of the contamination or perhaps eliminate it completely, it could be construed to mean only reducing the rate of contamination. Obviously, reducing the rate of new contamination may not meet the policies of Section 3 at the beginning of the bill. Subsection 2 of this section, starting on line 29, could also be improved by requiring that action plans also address the need to make any necessary changes in state or federal water pollution control permits and in the development or revision of contaminant spill prevention and cleanup plans. This concludes the comments that the Water Bureau has on Senate Bill 423. We'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions, Senator Bradbury?
I'm going back to your suggestion on Section 19. I guess my response, I don't know, I'm just responding to you in a way. You're saying that a water purveyor should be included in that, and that's fine, except there's no specification in that advisory committee of who's included at all. So, I mean, I guess the choice is either you start listing all the interests, and of course that's going to vary from community to community, or you leave it the way it is, which is, say, composed of at least seven members representing a balance of interest in the area affected by the declaration. I mean, I think you could very effectively argue that you, as the water purveyor, would be, you know, an interest, have an interest in that area. I mean, it's sort of like you don't really want to get to the place where you have to list everybody who has to be on one of these committees because it varies from place to place.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bradbury, I understand your concern, and that was, of course, a consideration that we made when drafting our comments. Again, I guess I could only say that the comments that we've made about seeing the water purveyor in a very pivotal and if not the principal role in protecting the health of the members of the public who buy water from the water purveyor was our reason for putting it in there.
Another question, Mr.
Bradbury.
Section 17 relating to the labs. I'm trying to remember. We created a certification program for what? Which labs was it? This was in Senate Labor for labs that do drug testing. A little different. Same. No, it's the same. It's the same thing, though. I mean, we wanted to make sure that the drug tests that were done by a certified lab that you could depend on.
Right.
And I think you've raised a good point here in terms of what labs we use to, you know, get to a place where we say, well, this is critical. We sure better be sure. I mean, what we're saying here is you got to get a second opinion, but you're not saying from who or what quality that lab is. And we're talking about, as I understand it, once you get past some of the more simple compounds, you start getting the parts per billion of organics or whatever, it gets a little bit, you got to have some pretty sophisticated test gear that's been calibrated correctly. So I guess I would just flag that as something that we might want to think about as a committee in terms of saying something about the laboratory. I don't know who.
That's correct, Senator. And the Health Division and the Drinking Water Program has a laboratory certification program, okay, but only for drinking water laboratories.
Right.
There are other laboratories that do water testing that don't have to be certified by that program. So I guess we would suggest that certification program be looked at as a place to, you know, to specify that.
So maybe we can use that existing certification process?
That's correct.
How much more do the tests cost at the certified labs than the non-certified
labs? generally, they don't.
Okay.
You folks, I assume, maintain some sort of testing capability within your own department.
That's correct.
Is there anything we should understand of significance about your testing in the well system that the City of Portland has developed in the aquifer out there in the South Columbia Shore area?
Well,
my understanding is that there's been some concern raised about the integrity of that aquifer, and as you know, East Multnomah County is going on sewers, I guess, in part out of a concern for groundwater quality, but they're obviously industrial sources are a concern as well.
Yeah, that's correct. We have a rather extensive monitoring program that is looking for these contaminants. As I said, we monitor for over 100 contaminants in our wells. Many of these are contaminants that are not regulated currently, but that we anticipate might be regulated or that are just they're simply things that are of concern to us. We've expanded our program to include testing not only in our wells, but in some of the regional area around our system. It's quite clear that there is a potential for groundwater contamination, either from the one site, the Boeing site, that's already been found, or from other sites, the other things that are out there. And that was really the whole motivation for the groundwater protection program that we have. And I guess why we're supportive of this bill is because we recognize that we can't stop groundwater contamination if we're confined to just those areas that we as the City of Portland have control over. We do need to be able to go beyond our political boundaries, and this bill would provide that kind of a mechanism to us.
I might add to that, Mr. Chairman, that the U.S. Geological Survey has been doing surveys for us in cooperation with the Water Resources Department and the Clark County Intergovernmental Resource Center for the past two or three years, and what they tell us is that the aquifers in the area immediately underlying this wellhead protection program area are sandwiched together in about four layers that are reasonably well separated from each other by layers of silt and clay and so on that are at least somewhat impermeable or more or less impermeable. But as you go out southward into the east side of the city of Portland, those clay lenses, if you will, begin to disappear. And as you get out into the recharge areas where our water comes from in the foothills of the Cascade Range, those separating layers that help protect each succeeding depth of aquifer begin to disappear. And that's one of the reasons that, again, that we support the bill is because of the interjurisdictional nature that the disappearance of those lenses create.
Okay, we hope that, Senator Bradbury.
One more. In your testimony, you spoke about, in Section 20, the current proposal is to call it an emergency groundwater area, and you're proposing to be called something a little bit less red flaggish. I can certainly understand your logic there. I guess I would just ask other people who testify to speak to that a little bit in terms of, you know, the view of that.
Well, the neighbors don't go crazy if you call it a groundwater enforcement area. Excuse me. I'm
Well,
Mr. Chairman, I'm sure that the committee. The fact of the matter is the reason you want to do that is that the neighbors don't go bats when you call it a groundwater enforcement area, as opposed to an emergency groundwater area and its impact on property values and what people have been doing out there all those years without regard to its potential impact when it comes around. When the impact is known, then you call it a groundwater enforcement area. Everybody goes, okay. I'm not saying that's the intent of the witness. That's one of the outcomes when you play around with semantics.
Okay. Further comments or questions? Thank you, gentlemen. We would appreciate very much any amendments you may suggest being put in the appropriate form, and we know that you certainly have the ability to do that, and we look forward to working with you.
Thank you.
Okay. Terry Witt.
We heard from NCAP.
Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Terry Witt, and I am the Executive Director of Oregonians for Food and Shelter. Thank you for this opportunity to comment on Oregon's proposed groundwater protection program introduced as Senate Bill 423. As I am sure most of you know, OFS has been actively involved in the process which led to the completion of this initial draft of Senate Bill 423. Our formal involvement included commenting on the initial strategy document and issue papers, participation in the three-day Subtle Lake retreat held by the Joint Interim Committee.